Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone or Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth. The following episode of The Projection Booth is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, please visit www.diabolikdvd.com.
1940, the Auschwitz death camp was manufactured, was built basically. 1941, the actual killings started.
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and joining me this week is Robo Host.
Greetings and salutations. I am Robo Host, and I am here to rock you.
Yes, it's a special treat. I've invested in the RoboHost 9000 program. I had all of our previous shows of the Projection Booth transcribed and input into the computer bank at Bell Labs. The result is supposed to be the perfect Projection Booth co-host.
That makes my circuits hard.
I don't even think that makes sense.
That is fine. This show does not make sense either. But in all seriousness, Mike, you have run the gamut of eclectic films on the Projection Booth.
Indeed.
This week is no exception. This week we are covering Auschwitz by filmmaker Uwe Boll. Love him or hate him, Uwe Boll, at least for me, remains a consummate artist, and his film Auschwitz proves this theory.
Yeah, Boll is as prolific as Takashi Miike and about as unpredictable. It's difficult to keep up with everything that Boll is doing. Auschwitz is one of the latest and not even available yet, legally at least, in the United States.
True, and that's why we chose to cover it. But we'll get into that a little more later on. So, Mike, I know that both you and I are only Boll fans in general and was curious to know, what do you find so special about his films?
I won't say that I enjoy every single one of Boll's films. There are some that are rather clunky. I'm not a big fan of his video game films for the most part. House of the Dead kind of left me a little cold. There are some of his films where I was just like, okay, yeah, this really isn't doing a whole lot for me. And I will admit that I heard a lot of bad things about Boll before I even gave one of his films a chance. And then finally, I came to Postal and really, really enjoyed Postal. I mean, I know it was silly as hell, but there was also just this kind of cynicism going through it that really showed kind of a sophistication that I hadn't experienced in any of his films before. Though I will say that I hadn't seen everything that he had done. I still haven't. I don't know if anyone has, other than Mr. Boll, seen all. I think he's up to like 29 films now that he's directed, and even more that he's produced. But seeing Postal really took the blinders off, as it were, and really gave me more respect for him and opened me up to taking his work seriously.
Are you a new Boll fan? Are you a Uwe Boll aficionado?
Do you even know what that word means?
Accessing. The question was part of my programming. The definition was not.
Robo, I'm going to see if all of the money I invested in your programming was truly worthwhile or not. I want to hear you sum up this week's film.
Auschwitz isn't for the faint of heart. Bull's graphic recreation of a day in the life of a notorious Holocaust concentration camp juxtaposes itself against modern-day German school students of all races, in which Bull interviews and to great effect in which he documents the lack of information being taught to school students about the atrocities of the Holocaust in modern-day Germany. Now, around this point usually is when I'd ask you about your opinions on the film, as sometimes some of the stuff I've brought to the table aren't films you are necessarily familiar with, but because no one really is familiar with this film here in the USA, I wanted to know what you thought about it. I'm looking for a sort of primal answer from you. I mean, for me this film is something really horrible, very powerful, startling, and important. So did Auschwitz hit you on any emotional levels like it did to me?
I don't know how it could affect your emotions since you don't have any.
Dr. Nguyen Singh gave me an emotion chip.
Oh, that's rather a dangerous thing. Hopefully you don't try to tell some jokes pretty soon, or anymore, I guess. So yeah, let's talk about Uwe Boll. A lot of people just completely malign his career. As I discussed before, he's been dismissed outright and really just kind of mocked. The internet kind of has it out for him. I mean, there were people that were trying to convince him to quit directing, these kind of jokey petitions to make him stop making movies. But there are a lot of things going on with Boll that really folks need to pay a little bit more attention to. I hesitate to liken him to Steven Soderbergh, but there are some things that he's doing that I find some parallels, at least in a real kind of glossy overlook way of what I'm seeing Boll doing versus what I see like a more respected, let's say, filmmaker like Soderbergh. You know, Soderbergh, he makes a lot of commercially viable films, say like Out of Sight or Traffic or Aaron Brockovich or some of these films. But then at the same time, he's making films like Schizopolis or Bubble, making these things that really falls outside of what anyone in the mainstream would be, you know, going and spending their $10 on a Saturday night to see. But he still feels very driven to make these films. And what I see is someone going through and basically paying their dues. You know, I'm going to make the commercial film, and then I'm going to make what I want to make. A lot of his mainstream films, they aren't just these kind of slapdash, let's blow things up, Michael Bay kind of things. They have a lot of art to them as well. So, but I will say that for me, Boll seems to do some of the same things where he's out there kind of paying the bills with, you know, A Blood Rain or House of the Dead or Seed or some of these kind of films, much more exploitative. A lot of these, again, are based on video games or video game franchises. And yeah, they're not that great. But in between those films, he's making some just amazing things. And even right out of the gate, I mean, one of his first American films that he made, you know, he made some films in his native Germany. Again, not very expected. I mean, one of his first films, German Fried Movie, just absolutely bonkers. I'm sure that a lot of it gets lost in translation. I mean, I've watched it with subtitles, of course, but some of the jokes are very German-specific, let's say. But even when he came to America, one of his first films that he did was Heart of America, which some people could say was very exploitative of the whole Columbine situation. But for me, I saw a whole lot of heart there. I mean, it wasn't, you know, Duck, the Carbine Massacre, or whatever the hell that thing is called. It was something that had a lot of meaning to it. And there's a progression there. I mean, between Heart of America and Rampage and Stoic and Attack on Darfur, it goes beyond exploitation into more of a social commentary and a social critique. And it's not just me being one of these film guys where I'm like, oh, well, you know, this B filmmaker was making these, you know, important statements inside of his B films. No, he kind of separates out those kind of things and makes his own very important statements as he goes along. I mean, there are some important statements in something like Postal, but that one really, for me, is kind of the Rosetta Stone of Uwe Boll, where it's the video game films, and it is the exploitation, and it's the social commentary, all of these things, and the comedy. You know, he's got a lot of humor in his films. And again, these things kind of all collide one more time when we're talking about Auschwitz. Now, before anyone gets crazy, there's no comedy in Auschwitz. But what I'm talking about is when he made Auschwitz, the making of this film is just fascinating to me. He made this film, he was going to make Blood Rain 3, which is actually, it's a sequel, but it's set back in the World War II days, blah, blah, blah. So he's got the sets, and he says, okay, well, I've got these sets here. You know, what I'm going to do is after we shoot the real scene with Blood Rain 3, then I'm going to have this other actress come in, and I'm going to reshoot the scene, but for comedy, and we're going to call it Blubberella. Well, then he goes one step further and takes some of those same sets and basically, it sounds like he kicks everybody out the last few days of what he's scheduled for, or buys a few more days worth of time, and he makes this very important social docudrama, for lack of a better term, about Auschwitz and this dark period of history. And he takes it outside of that period of history and shows what's going on today. The film has a fascinating structure for me. It is bookended with Bol himself. In between that, you've got interviews with students, two groups of students, one from a higher echelon of classes versus a lower echelon. And what's funny is that I would expect that the kids at the higher echelon school would be spouting out, you know, all of the true facts that are going on with Auschwitz, because he's asking these questions off camera about what they've learned about Auschwitz and about the Holocaust. But no, the mixture is actually, I won't say it's even, but there are a lot of kids from the lower echelon school that have a lot of good points to make, or who have actually paid attention. Those sandwich everything. And then in between that, what he has is a day in the life at Auschwitz. And even that, I would say, has a structure to it that is similar, as far as it starts and ends with a trainload of people, going into the gas chamber. And in between, right in the middle of the film, I don't know if it's chronologically in the middle, you know, if it's right there at the 35-minute mark or whatever it would be, the whole film is about an hour and 10. Right there at the heart of the thing is what Arden would call the banality of evil. You've got two SS officers who are discussing the problems that they're having with one of the ovens not working correctly, where they're going on vacation. And again, with Bol, you would think, okay, if he's going to screw up at any time, if he's going to have these people start making jokes or just be disrespectful of the material, this is the point where it's going to happen. But no, he plays it straight, very effective. It really is just this kind of workaday thing. And what he's saying is that this whole setup is just this is their job. This is what they do. This is their day-to-day life. And they don't really see any kind of problem with it. They are so used to it, and they just take it all in stride. And it really speaks to that kind of, you know, even though they're in this business of killing people, for them and for the Nazi people, the German people, it was this kind of, this is what's happening. And there was no real questioning of it. There was no hysteria as far as what they were concerned. And really, what's effective to me too is outside with the actual gas chambers and these kind of scenes, there's not a ton of hysteria because it's all happening so fast. It's not like some of these other scenes that you've seen in other movies. What I respect as well that he's done is listening to his audio commentary. Bol has talked about having a few characters that he was going to follow through this whole process of arriving and getting checked in and then getting into the gas chamber, et cetera, et cetera. And that reminded me a lot of the girl in the red coat from Schindler's List, where you see this girl, she comes back, you can always see kind of a shift in the actual film stock itself when it goes from black and white stock to a color stock that's been sapped of every color except for her red coat. But there was not a happy ending for the girl in the red coat, but it gave you this kind of someone to latch on to. And really throughout Schindler's List, it gave you a lot of characters to latch on to outside of just Oscar Schindler and Amon Goeth and these kind of characters. But you pulled for these people and you were watching for them. You know, what about the little boy who was in the, you know, latrine and all this kind of stuff? And I think that was smart that Bol didn't give you any of those signposts. He didn't give you anyone to latch on to. He didn't give you hope at all. And he really just stripped that all out and made it so stark that it was even more effective and even more hard-hitting. One of the other things I should say about this whole sequence, too, starting with the gas chambers and ending with the gas chambers, is that it feels very real-time as well. You know, I mentioned before that the film is only about 70 minutes long, and this middle sequence feels like it's being played out very much against the clock. I haven't gone through and said, you know, I haven't looked to see if this plays out completely in a real-time scenario, and really there is no clock on the wall to be able to judge, but it feels very much, and it plays like this is what's happening right now, and see just how the process had gotten so efficient that people would come in, they would get checked in, they would go into the gas chambers, okay, clean it up, and now it's ready for the next batch. And that also is very, very hard-hitting. And I'm not necessarily letting the emotions that I felt while I was watching this film come through. Maybe you can hear it in my voice a little bit, but this is, as you said, RoboHost, or we're programmed to say, however it is. I'm not sure about the algorithms, but it's not for the faint of heart.
Let us play back the interview Mike did with Uwe Boll about Auschwitz. Roll that tape.
Can you tell me what sparked the idea of making Auschwitz at this time?
Okay, there was of course no chance to finance a movie like Auschwitz in a way that somebody actually would give me the money for it. It was impossible. Also, subsidies was impossible. And then when I had it in my head a longer time, when I shot the Darfur movie, Attack on Darfur, about the genocide in Sudan, it was kind of in my brain to say to make a movie about. Okay, what actually happened in Auschwitz, like on a daily basis, in a daily routine, and in all the movies made about the subject matter, you never saw, in a way, the genocide, you know, and like the actual killings. That Auschwitz was almost like a meat plant for humans, and I felt it would be good to make a movie without heroes, without. In a way, even real actors, and to just show what actually really happened in Auschwitz. Yeah, so 540,000 people were killed in Auschwitz the same day they arrived. And where's the story about them, basically? You know, so sometimes when you see a lot of Hollywood movies about the Holocaust, you think you could really live in that circumstances a longer time, and you almost could. You had your information system, and you whatever got friends with people and stuff like this. But it's not true. The reality is that it was a death camp, and you were really fast en route into the gas chamber, basically when you came in. Based on I couldn't get any financing, that when I shot Blood Rain 3 and I had all the setup for Second World War, and in the Blood Rain 3 script was even a scene playing in a concentration camp, I felt, okay, now or never. So I added from my own money the a few hundred thousand to make it happen and to add it to the shoot. And nobody wanted to do it. When I told the production designer, like, build a gas chamber, build an oven, and stuff like this, these were actually built. So we did that. They were like, no, I don't want to do it. This movie makes no sense, blah, blah, blah. Even my cameraman, Matthias Neumann, and my producer, Dan Clark, were against it. So, and they really, when we actually shot it, they saw what I was going for.
I was curious what kind of research you've done on the subject. So much of your film is about education. How did you get educated about the Holocaust?
Growing up in Germany, and I'm born in 65, you really, at this point, you really got massive school teaching about this. Then I read books and so on and so on. I even wrote a 25 pages thing in school when I was like in the last class before exam about IG Farben, that they basically manufactured the Cyclone B and everything, and then what happened to the IG Farben after the Second World War, that they spread out into a Bayer Leverkusen, BASF, and Herx. So they're all three big chemical giants. So today they used Jewish people as slaves and so on, and they still
like out there and existing and bigger as ever. I saw all the documentaries, all the movies about the Holocaust, you know, like whatever, from Night and Fog to, of course, Schindler's List as a pianist, a boy in the striped pajama, like the Holocaust TV show, the BBC documentary about it, Shoah. I grew up with it, basically. And I had intense discussions with my family, my grandparents and my aunt and so on. They were all alive during the Second World War. And so to find out what was their involvement in the war, in the Hitler Party or not in the Hitler Party, it depends. And what was their experience during that time period?
Evidenced by your film, kids aren't getting that much education about the Holocaust these days. Was there a particular time where you think that folks stopped caring or learning about it? Or what are your opinions on that?
This is the thing. It's like when I went to the German schools to actually check, okay, how much they know about the Holocaust now, I asked like 10 schools to that I can come in and do interviews, and everybody passed. Like everybody said no. Then the two schools, one lower end school, one high end school, both said, okay, we agree. And then they actually teach their kids like for a week intense history, intense Holocaust. They all watched Schindler's List, whatever. So and then I came in and did the interviews, and as you saw with the movie, it's kind of shocking, even after like Auschwitz boot camp, basically, they have no fucking clue what is going on. Yeah, so this is the thing, what is sensational. So if you would actually go in normal schools without any pre-warning, let's say you walk in a school and you interview people, I think it would be like a rough awakening. And at the same time, when you think about other countries, think about whatever, Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe, when a lot of people, if German schools are not teaching it, so what is in the rest of the world? So from this perspective, if you have now a guy like Amargeniat or that Catholic bishop or whatever, and they say there was no Auschwitz, there was no Holocaust at all, and we think the guys are completely retarded, but wait a second, you know, like I think that 80% of the people on Earth, they actually don't know what Auschwitz was. So if then somebody says Auschwitz never happened, they basically are maybe, yeah, okay with it. And they think, well, it's typical American propaganda or whatever, you know, and they believe Amargeniat. This is the crazy thing.
Yeah, I don't know what was more horrifying, the recreation of Auschwitz or the kids who were talking about Auschwitz.
Yeah, this is the thing. I think both things in the movie make a lot of sense, that they are that I opened the movie with the interviews and finished the movie with the interviews makes a lot of sense. And to show, like, basically without any real actors one day in Auschwitz makes also sense, based on the fact of that the world doesn't know it anymore, that they are not interested anymore, that they deny it. And so I think it's important to show, yes, the people got selected, they got in the gas chambers. And I have to say, for example, the shooting of the babies, this was one of the most horrible things I had to shoot ever, because the babies were crying for real. And I, of course, we did CGI gunshots, and we didn't did real, like with sound gunshots, so to not to bring the kids into a stressful situation. And but in reality, in that BBC documentary, what I saw, there was a guy who he said, like, he had to hold up the babies on the ears, actually holding up on the ears, and then they got shot in the head. And 26,000 babies and small kids got shot behind the gas chamber in Auschwitz. And if you think about this, like, besides my video game-based movies, like in the movies I've written, the movies I developed, like Amok, Lauf, Run Amok, what I did in Germany, then and Heart of America, Darfur, Rampage, Stoic, this kind of movies where my heart is in, I always look out for like human existence. You know, like what are humans? Like what are humans capable of? What are humans good or bad from born on, or neutral? And you can move humans in any kind of direction. When the actual witnesses or people they gave interviews later, the SS people and Jewish survivors, they all said it was kind of a calm atmosphere. It was not this kind of mega drama. So people got killed. Some people helped, like, undressing, took the wardrobe away. And this was it. And the people were actually really talking about why Oven 3 is not working anymore. And not like about, oh my God, what are we doing? We are murderers. No, It was like when you go on holidays. This is, I think, is a scary thing of the movie.
Did you ever give any kind of thought when you were doing Auschwitz, or have you given thought since then of going into an American school and seeing what American kids are learning about the Holocaust as well?
I agree. It would be a good add-on to actually check this, to see what's going on here. But maybe this can be, if the US company will finally take the movie out, this could be an add-on on the DVD, that we just do that and we go in a school here and we check the situation out here.
Well, it was so telling to me, too, the differences between the two schools.
The thing is this, we were like even in the high-end school, if you see the interviews, there are like 3 or 4 boys, they really know what they're talking about. And the rest, even the girls or whatever, there's that girl with the German flag on her chin or whatever as a collar thing. And she's from the high-end school. And I think she doesn't really know what she's talking about. And a lot of people, like from the 25 kids in that school class, only like 10 were even saying, okay, I do the interview. 15 were just sitting there silent and they didn't want to do an interview. So what shows me, who knows what they would say.
What was the time frame that we're talking about with using these sets and shooting all 3 movies?
It was like a plan to do like Barbarella, always, of course, parallel and at the same time where we shot Blood Rain. Basically, we exchanged Natasha Malta as Blood Rain and put the fat Lindsay Hollister in. And we made a spoof out of the whole Blood Rain franchise, basically. And this turned out in the end as very stressful. It was too much work, and we had problems with, let's say, getting it all together on time. I spent all the time to do Blood Rain, and then for Barbarella was not enough time. For the actors like Clint Howard, Michael Paré, whoever was in the real version and was in the spoof, they had a lot of fun just playing the same scene again in absurd or over the top or like just switching in a different character. And they really liked it. So it was kind of fun to do it. At the same time, I felt like we're running out of time. And when I think in the director's commentary of Barbarella, I said like this 90 minutes movie is like half really, really funny. It's like my postal movie or something like this, or whatever, Naked Gun kind of humor and really funny. But the other half is just like completely devastating crap. If you want to find the whole movie funny, you have to get some drinks if you watch it. Then it can be actually really funny. The absurd thing is also when I did the commentary, or I did even my own, I play Hitler in the Barbarella movie in a cameo. And when I adapt myself in German, it was kind of the most absurd, not working scenes are basically the funniest scenes in the end now in the movie. So because it's just like you just watch it and you think like, I cannot believe it. Yeah, so that is so dumb that it's really funny. So a little like the hey dude, where's my car? You know, like this kind of humor where you think like this is just nihilistic. But I made the decision to separate Auschwitz from this. So we never had people cast on set or something when we shot Auschwitz. So we made that totally separate. Also, the shooting days were separate. And when we were done with Blood Rain and Barbarella, we added 3 more shooting days to do the gas chamber scenes and the oven scenes, what we built in the studio in between. It was really, we did the first gassing scene, and our casting directors for extras, basically, they had a tough time to find in Croatia the extras that were willing to get naked, they're willing to do it. And then we shot the first scene with the first load, basically, of people. Even it was very hard to shoot, and everybody was like on the edge, basically. And then we felt like this is not it. It's like I said, like we need another full load of people. They all have to go naked, and we need the gas chamber thing basically again. So we had to wait a few days, and then we shot that again. There was already the rest of the crew. Everything was like already like from payroll, and we had to go get back and shoot that again. And then this is the reason that I was able to cut it this way, that during the first people walking from the train into the concentration camp, you have basically already that you see it's an ongoing process, basically. And not, it took around 16 minutes to kill everybody in the gas chamber. And then you can say it takes another 30, 40 minutes to bring the people in and to carry the bodies out. So you could basically do around 5 to 6 loads a day.
You had mentioned in your commentary that you were going to have a couple characters that you were going to follow through the process. What changed your mind on that?
The kid what gets in the oven and burns was an original replique, basically, of a real existing kid. And I hired that kid with the father as the lead actor. And we followed with one camera on this guy's. But then I felt in the editing room that this is just stupid, because then you sit there and you think, oh, hopefully that kid survives. You know, like, and this was totally absurd, because I felt like it's not about the kid. It's about the process. And it doesn't matter if the kid survives or not. So I don't want that emotion in the audience that they feel sorry for one individual, like for one person. I wanted that the audience feels this is similar to what really happened, and there was no time for say goodbye, hugging again, crying that family's getting torn apart. No, this is how it goes in real, you know. It's just like you cannot even say goodbye. Like, you get dragged over and you walk and the other people stay and it's over. You will be ashes in the next 2 hours or 3 hours. So if you're interested in reality, what I am in my life, this is what you have to go through when you don't turn your face away, you know, when you face reality. And then that something like this can never happen again. A few people interviewed me and more people getting it, what I was really doing there. And I like it that I'm not alone thinking that this made absolute sense to do it this way.
What has been the reaction, both in Germany and in other European places? Have you heard much from your American audience as far as this has been? Because it's a little bit of a challenge to get the film. I mean, it's been easier lately, but what's been the reaction that you've heard?
Yeah, it's a mix. I think the movie will hopefully get shown in the LA Jewish Film Festival. She had a screener now. So far, I did a few theatrical screenings in Germany and got very good response there. In the beginning, when only the teaser was out, I got like trashed into the ground that I made a torture porn Auschwitz movie, basically. And I said, wait and see the whole movie before you judge. And so now I'm really happy when people actually see the full thing, what the concept was. And now I think I slowly convince more people that it's actually good that the movie was shot.
With you, you don't know if you're going for the laugh or for the cutting. You can go either way. I mean, with Postal, you kind of have a perfect mix of all of it. You've got the commentary on society as well as the humor going on. So I know personally I was afraid that you were going to go for an Auschwitz laugh.
I'm happy that I didn't do that. Yeah. So I'm a fan of cynical stuff and cynical movies, as you know from Postal. But at the same time, I'm also, let's say, somebody who always advertises we are living on Earth and we should not, let's say, look away from real problems, situations where we have to get involved to stop them. If it's a genocide in Sudan, or if it's like a situation, school shootings and violence from kids like Rampage, or what I did with Heart of America, or situations in prisons with my movie Stoic, what is based on a real case out of a German prison, put the finger in the wound, basically, and say, look, we have to change this situation. We cannot bomb Libya, but in Sudan are 400,000 kids and women hacked in pieces. And then we bomb Libya because Gaddafi killed 20 people in terror attacks in the last 10 years. So the thing is, like, it's completely absurd. This kind of under what criteria the NATO and so on is playing world police. Yeah, so if they would say we're only out for the money, we only bomb states they have oil or whatever, yeah, then it's fair. Then you know what it is. The reality is that if we, let's say, explain military actions with morality, what we did since September 11, like Afghanistan, everything was moral driven. We said we have to help the Afghanistan people, we have to find Al-Qaeda, we have to help free Iraq or now Libya or whatever. And then at the same time, the biggest massacres, the biggest genocides like Rwanda, Congo, Sudan, that we do absolutely nothing to stop them. So I think this is the lie we're living in, you know. So I think the politics at least should have the the proud and honor to say how it really is, that we only need some cheap excuses to protect the oil reservoirs worldwide and to have the control over the things that really matter.
Uwe Boll, he just makes video game movies. Do you still find that as a cross that you have to bear, or is that just more of a, it's something that you want to do, or is it more of a means to an end?
In a way, it's bothering me. I think I made so many non-video game movies as I made video game-based movies. So it's not like in between I made one movie I really wanted to do. I made like 5-6 movies in the last 4 years where I'm really in with all of my heart political subject matters, even if it's Tunnel Rats, a Vietnam War movie, and so on. There's a lot of movies I did like this. And I'm a little pissed that if you read, like, especially you go on the horror websites or the video game websites or like the websites that they write about me, Ain't It Cool or Dread Central or all that stuff, Fangoria, and so on. It looks like they almost ignore the other movies. And this is what is a little pissing me off, to be honest. Yeah, and I think it's unfair, especially if you have really, really good movies. And I think Rampage or Attack on Darfur are really, really good movies. And I think it's kind of bad for this kind of movies then if they don't get the attention they should get. I hope that will change. I hope that people see that I did a wide range of movies and a lot of directors out there, you know, like how much movies Eli Roth made or whatever, you know, like and what kind of movies, like whatever, 2 or 3 horror movies, this was it. End of story. You know, I made 29 movies from like mega $60 million Jason Statham movies to whatever, Alone in the Dark, but also like dramas and comedies. And I hope that journalists as historical film journalists, in a way, you know, like as journalists, they want to see the whole Uwe Boll, that they actually take it serious enough to slowly see the whole range of movies I did. And I think this is sinking in, surely.
What's next for you? Where are you setting your sights on next?
Another passion project, besides like I developed Blood Rain 4, is Bailout. Bailout is about the financial crisis, but more a movie like Taxi Driver, more a movie like Falling Down. So you have a guy who's losing everything in the crisis, his pension, his job, his wife, his kid, his apartment and everything. And then he sees like the guy who sold him all the worthless real estate certificates and all that stuff. First, he gets fired also, but then a half year later, the guy drives a new Porsche and has another job in another bank, and he lost his existence, all his joy and fun and money and sense. And so, and then he goes after them and starts killing all the investment bankers. And even the police, in a way, is like covering him up because they feel that there is no real justice against. Take Richard Fuld of Lehman Brothers. You know, the taxpayers have to pay the bill, and he sits home with 500 million private wealth, and his bank went under. Why he's not in jail? Why he when he damaged the American budget, $900 billion alone, Lehman Brothers, and then he can keep his paychecks and sits there in his villa and works on his handicap. And 7 million Americans lost their houses and are in foreclosure. And 4,000 or 5,000 Americans did suicide after the existence went down the drain. And where's that movie for those people? And I want to make that movie, you know, a very, let's say, angry movie about that subject matter. And not like I was so disappointed about Wall Street 2. I just couldn't believe it that Oliver Stone, like, comes up with a movie like this. Where he has all the things together. He has money, he has the actors and everything. And then this is his point of view. Like, then he's just a spoiled asshole. I was very disappointed about that movie.
Are you going to touch on the whole Occupy movement?
Yeah, absolutely. We will have in the script revised to this, basically, because the script is already like 7 or 8 months old. And now where that movement comes, we will integrate them and we will shoot in the crowd. And he will be in the crowd also. And he will be one of the people who he's not lifting up his voice, but he thinks like, okay, they're standing here and demonstrate, but what will happen? The really rich bankers or whatever, they just laugh about it. They think, oh, yeah, I have to go through whatever. We need one security guy more down at the parking lot, you know, so stuff like this. And this is what I think, that with that arrogance they went through this, it's completely unacceptable.
When people finally see Auschwitz here in the United States, what's the one thing that you want them to take away from your film?
Definitely that education is the most important thing. And at the same time, not closing the eyes in front of reality and never forget what happened in history, to not repeat mistakes, to not make things happen again where things getting extreme or things getting radical or where like justice is just off. And because humans are capable of everything. And humans are not good per birth. So the dangerous thing with humans is that you can put them in any direction. And so it's important that the government and the democracy system keeps us en route. And for this, it's, I think, very important that we're not getting brainwashed, that we have informations from all sides and that we have free informations from all sides coming into us with school, with family, with friends, with internet and TV and newspapers. And because not a lot of, like half of the globe still doesn't have that. They only see filtered stuff. And I think this is the biggest goal, like to just get it out there that what really happened in history or what really happened in reality.
Okay. So another thing I really want to talk about is how Auschwitz sort of fits into the scheme of things.
Meaning?
Well, I mean how Auschwitz fits into it all. How does a film like this fit into the pattern of other films involving the Holocaust? Could you compare a film like this to something like The List of Schindler or Life is Beautiful?
Well, I've already compared it a little bit to Schindler's List, talking about how it's differing from the Spielberg film. There's drama to this, but then there's also the documentary part to this. And I know that Schindler's List also had that kind of documentary bent, at least right at the end, the scenes in Israel and putting the stones on Oscar Schindler's grave, those kind of things, which I could see where some people would have problems with that, because it really is just this kind of, it doesn't fit with the rest of the film. It worked for me, but then there are other films that kind of tried to do the same thing, like when Spielberg kind of did a similar thing with Saving Private Ryan. I mean, not as dramatic, and again, it wasn't real. That ending wasn't real, so that felt very ham-fisted as far as the old man by the grave, that kind of thing. But as far as comparing it to Life is Beautiful, I mean, Life is Beautiful played with my emotions a lot, and I actually respected that quite a bit, because it had me laughing and it had me crying, and really Benigni knew what he was doing with that kind of film. But as far as comparing this film to other Holocaust films, if I had to compare it to anything, I suppose I would really kind of lean more towards the documentaries. I would look at things more like Night and Fog, or, you know, even we talked about Sam Fuller's Falknow documentary when we covered The Big Red One. So, RoboHost, I mean, give me a hand here and tell me, when you're thinking about Holocaust films, what kind of films you're thinking about.
Here is a list of Holocaust-related films sorted chronologically. The Seventh Cross, The Stranger, The Last Stage, Our Children, The Surge, Long Is the Road, Distant Journey, The Juggler, Singing in the Dark, Stars, The Diary of Anne Frank, Operation Anthropoid, Exodus, The Ninth Circle, Judgment at Nuremberg, Samson.
RoboHost, if I may interrupt, it sounds like you're listing off just about every film with a Holocaust theme that's ever been created. Could you narrow that down a little bit, or give me more of a specific era as far as what you would consider to be a better sample of Holocaust films?
Recalculating. In the future, please state the correct parameters initially. Here is your new list: The Pawnbroker, The Last Days, Empire of the Sun, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, Night and Fog, Life is Beautiful, Schindler's List, The Day the Clown Cried, Men of the Sun, Shoah, Triumph of the Spirit, La Revoir Laid on France.
So I will admit something that I wrote about this years ago, so I won't say that I haven't admitted it in public before, but I have seen a section of Showa, I believe about 2 hours. It felt like nine, though I think that's the whole running time of Showa. And Showa, for me, it wasn't very effective. I mentioned the phrase banality of evil before, but I would say that this was just banality, period. There were things that just weren't well done in Showa as far as the actual filmmaking process itself. It felt like the filmmakers were saying, you know, this is such an important subject, which it is, that we really need to dedicate a whole bunch of time to this. But they didn't have the actual material to fill up that amount of time, so they wasted a lot of screen time doing a lot of things that were just poor documentary style. What I recall of Showa are conversations where you're hearing the filmmaker ask a question, you're hearing the translator ask the same question, you're hearing the person that they're talking to respond, you're hearing the translator respond to that question, and then you're hearing the filmmaker ask the follow-up. And it was just excruciating. Just give me the person off screen or even on screen asking the question and then give me the answer. I don't need to hear the translation. And maybe that was just to be this kind of cinema verite. You know, we are going to make sure that there's nothing lost in translation, or, you know, some of these kind of things, like show me your notes kind of stuff. But God, it was awful. And the other thing that I remember a lot, well, I remember two things from Showa quite a bit. There was one where they are walking around where there used to be buildings, and you're seeing these bricks of what used to be a concentration camp or whatever, and you're not getting any kind of historical photos. It's like, this is the time where if you had any footage or if you had any pictures, this would be the time to show it. You know, cut back to these things and show me the real breadth of these things that you're showing me. Don't just say, and over here and over there, and this guy's pointing and he's in the middle of a field. I'm not able to get the sense of what he's talking about. The other thing was this excruciating conversation about people who are on the trains going into one of the death camps, and the German people who lived outside of it would signal to them that they were going to their death. They would do this by making these slicing motion with their finger across their neck, you know, which is pretty much universal. You're going to get it kind of a signal. I mean, I don't know if the Bushmen of the Kalahari would do the same kind of thing if they were trying to signal someone that they were going to die. And it was like the filmmaker had never seen this motion before and just couldn't believe this thing, and had so many people describing this to them and just carrying on and like, what were they doing? I don't understand. And it was just like, oh my God, really? Are you that clueless? Or are you trying to make a point? Because if you're trying to make a point, I'm not getting it. What I'm getting is that you're an idiot. So what really brought that home to me is that same thing happens in Schindler's List, and it happens again. Someone, you know, they're going, the train's going into one of the death camps, and they just really quickly show a little kid outside of the train making that motion, and that's it. You know, you get maybe 15 frames of this. Spielberg takes care of this in 15 frames, whereas it took about 15 minutes at least in Showa for them to discuss this. And it's like, I can't imagine what the other 7 hours of Showa were like, because I just happened to wander in, had some friends who were taking an Evil in Cinema class at U of M from Ira Konigsberg. I was curious to see this because I am, well, to use your term, robo-host, I am an aficionado of Holocaust documentaries, and I wanted to see this thing because it was supposed to be this important, and when I saw it, I just couldn't believe, and then I couldn't imagine what the other 7 hours were, and I really felt for my housemates who had to sit through all of that.
Mike, I want you to tell the audience about the rather unscientific experiment you did regarding education in the USA about the Holocaust.
When we were preparing to do this show originally, I posted a question to my Facebook page and got a lot of responses of people who have children who are of high school or junior high age or shortly thereafter, and when they learned or what they learned about the Holocaust. And strangely, pretty much everybody said that their kids learned about the Holocaust in high school, which was great. There was no one who said that they didn't. The strange thing to me was that just about everyone who responded said that they learned about this in English class and not in social studies, history, world religions, any of those kind of classes. So it was very strange to me that this would be something that's covered under the English curriculum. And what I found was a lot of people were reading the Diary of Anne Frank. That was their exposure, which I don't think necessarily gives you the horror of the Holocaust. And I mean, it's a good introduction and it gives you a protagonist with whom you can empathize quite a bit, especially if you're a teenage girl, but it's not going to give you the information. It's not going to give you the horror of what the Holocaust was. The other thing that really was apparent was that Oprah really has brought a lot to Holocaust education by bringing Elie Wiesel's book Night to the fore with her Oprah Book Club, however many years ago that was. But after that, a lot of people added that to their curriculum. I don't necessarily think that that was always a standard book to read in high school beforehand, but I think that that's definitely been adopted since. So again, I know that's another book that we're talking about, not a movie, but another book, another assigned reading category in English class, as opposed to a chapter in your history book talking about this. And I mean, it's got to be tough to teach the history of the world in 4 years, much less bring home the weight and importance of what happened during a period of years during one war. And then when you think about it, when I posted my question about the Holocaust, one of my friends actually questioned, well, which Holocaust? And she said the Armenian Holocaust. And it's like, oh yeah, there are other Holocausts. There are other genocides that are going on. I mean, the thing that really drove me crazy a few years ago when they were talking about Sudan is that there was such pussyfooting around the word genocide when American policymakers were talking about what was happening over there, because if they used the word genocide, then that would mean that we had to do something about it. So instead, they came up with nice little phrases like ethnic cleansing, or there were talks of tribal wars, these kind of things, because they didn't want to say there was a genocide going on, because, oh, geez, that means that we have to actually stop it. I mean, gosh, how inconvenient for America. We'd much rather worry about some place where we can, you know, make a little money off of stuff. I mean, do something more sexy than go in and actually stop people from trying to wipe out an entire race of other people. That's just not, you know, anything that we really want to get involved in right now, is it? So that was just horrible to hear that kind of stuff and really realize why Colin Powell, when he was talking about things, was using every word that he possibly could except for genocide, because as soon as he did, it was almost like a trigger was going to be pulled, as in a manner of speaking, and bam, we were suddenly obligated, and that was just so awful. So I've talked a lot about books that are being read, and really, you know, of course, The Projection Booth is a movie show, so if there was a movie that were to be shown to American school children, I don't really know what that movie would be. I don't want to say that we should be showing them any kind of a narrative film, something that is going to be playing with that whole sense of what a narrative is, what a drama is. I don't think we need to have that kind of good guys versus bad guys kind of thing. I don't think that we really need to emphasize the good guys in this film, because really there weren't good guys when it came down to it. I mean, there might have been an occasional person who was trying to make a difference or something that was going on that stands out. But again, I think something like Auschwitz shows that kind of day-to-day-to-day kind of thing where you're not seeing what stood out. You're seeing what happened the majority of the days. You're not seeing the liberation of the camps. You're seeing the camps as they were, as they operated throughout their life. And then I think about documentaries and what documentaries should be shown. I mean, when I saw Night and Fog, it tore the heart out of me. I don't know if that is something good to show kids, because that is so disturbing that they might shut down if they see that, or they might be so inured to violence or to seeing, you know, fake dead bodies that they might see this and be like some of those crazy people and think that it's not real. And, you know, here we are raising a generation of Holocaust deniers, God forbid. But so I would think that really, and I'm not just saying this, but I think that something like Auschwitz does do a good job and it opens up a dialogue. I don't know if it's necessarily something that should be shown to kids in school because there's so much misinformation in it. And really, unless you have the information at your fingertips where you know some of the things that are in the film. And what I'm talking about is not the actual middle part. I'm not talking about the docudrama middle part of it. I'm talking about the interviews at the beginning and the end with the kids where some of them know their stuff and some of them are giving you the right information and other people are giving you absolutely false information and showing just how little they don't know. I mean, it reminded me of that old phrase, better to keep your mouth closed and be thought a fool than to open it and remove all doubt. I mean, these kids are opening their mouths and making themselves look foolish, and I don't think that they know that they are. In fact, I know that they don't think that they are. They think that what they're saying is true. And then it brings to question about the kids who didn't open their mouths in these class. What were they thinking, and what information do they have? So I don't want to say that Bowles should go through and give little like true and false kind of things and show the actual statistics and figures and true information along the bottom of the screen while these kids are talking. Wouldn't work with the subtitles anyway, but there's got to be a better way where they can get this information so that they would know that when these kids are talking that they have no clue what they're talking about. I mean, there's one kid who's like, oh yeah, I think it was like 600 people or maybe it was 6,000 people rather than 6 million people. So it's like, yeah, there's a big difference there, kiddo. You know, can I give you $600 or would you rather have $6 million? There's going to be a big difference between those two piles of money. So maybe you might want to think about it just a little bit more. But it's scary to hear these kids talking and realize that they don't know what the hell's going on. And then I'm very curious what would happen if these same questions were being asked in U.S. schools. Would they know the difference? Would they know what happened? Do they have this level of education? And it makes me curious about where this dropped off. I mean, I don't even know if my peers really have all their facts and figures straight. And this is something that, again, I said before, and while I hate to say that I'm very into Holocaust documentaries, I'm very interested in Holocaust documentaries because there's a lot of information that I want to know. And I don't know if necessarily everybody else has this drive. There's a lot of people that just say, this is depressing, keep me out of it. I mean, I will say something to the same effect when it comes to Holocaust dramas, that I think that sometimes the Holocaust is just kind of thrown into a narrative to be a device, a very simple narrative device to say, okay, well, oh, well, he was a Nazi, and so obviously he's evil. I mean, it kind of goes back to that whole online argument thing where, you know, who calls a Nazi first is basically, you know, quote-unquote winning the argument here online.
We are going to take a break. I need to put some oil on my gears, fa fa fa, while you listen to these words from our sponsors.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Specializing in horror, cult, and other oddities on DVD and Blu-ray, Diabolik DVD has been owned and operated by the same fine folks for the last 10 years. They proudly feature in-demand titles by companies like Mondo Macabro, Synapse Films, Blue Underground, Arrow UK, Severin, and many others. Get prompt shipping to anywhere around the world and quick replies to your customer service questions. Follow them on Facebook and stop over at DiabolikDVD.com. Because you heard this on the Projection Booth podcast, take 10% off your $75 order today using the coupon code DiabolikDB10. That's DiabolikPB10. Visit DiabolikDVD.com today.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. For a limited time, you'll get 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com. Yes, get 50% off when you use the coupon code BOOTH at checkout, as in John Wilkes Powers or the Projection Booth. But that's not all. You'll also receive 3 free adult DVDs and free shipping on your entire order. Too good to be true? It's not. Check out adamandeve.com today for this special offer. Once again, that coupon code is BOOTH at adamandeve.com.
Before we go in, I just want you to know that until now, no other person besides myself has been in this room. I just want to ask that no food or drink be brought inside. Is this just a test, or do I have seconds to live?
You know, Wern, radiation death is an ugly thing.
This machine shows there's an afterlife. It proves it. You just threw away a chance to be very rich.
Very important.
Now, my friends, the only difference between a soul that is saved and a soul that is lost is that one is saved. The other's lost. You know this whore of Moscow?
Mr. Blick, you've been quoted as saying that this invention will change the way people will think about their lives. What exactly did you mean by that?
People will be happy and not sad. I have a gun.
Yes, so have I.
If I hijack this bus, then the price would come real quick. I mean, I wouldn't really hijack it. Oh, no, this is stupid fashion.
No! Hijacking!
This is the culmination of over 2 years of nearly continuous work.
That was audio from next week's show, all about the film Static. And I'll be joined by fellow Cashews de Cinema art writer Chris Cummins on that episode. Really looking forward to talking to him.
When are we covering Electric Dreams?
No plans on doing Electric Dreams anytime soon.
How about Colossus, the Forbin Project?
No Colossus, the Forbin Project.
Colossus is what my wife calls me in bed. J-O. How about 2001 A Space Odyssey?
Yeah, there are plans on doing 2001 A Space Odyssey in April.
Great. So I will talk with you again then.
No plans on bringing you back.
To your earlier point, I would be remiss to say that you are an asshole.
Well, it was an interesting experiment, but I can't really say that it was too successful.
You don't know what you are missing.
So with that, we've come to the end of another show. Be sure to check out the official site, www.projection-booth.com. Plus, there's always Stitcher, Jackalope, and iTunes, of course.
Feedback.
Stuart Feedback Andrews. Yes, thanks, Feedback, for help on the show. And listener feedback and a rating on iTunes would be great as well. All right, tune in next week. Same bad time, same bad channel.
Mine was blank. I needed time to think, get the memories from my mind. What did I see? Can I believe that what I saw that night was real and not just fancy? Just what I saw in my own dreams were the reflections of my warped mind staring back at me. 'Cause in my dreams it's always there, the evil face that twists my mind, brings me to. Thank you. fires blazed, sacred chants were praised. And as they start to cry, their hands held to the sky. In the night, fires burning bright, the ritual has begun.
Not only have I seen that film, but I have it on Laserdisc.